and a member of the committee.
Good morning, Malahela MJ. I'm a member of parliament and a member of ANC.
Thank you.
I'm Ruth Mahau, member of parliament and member of ANC. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mpoa Mashaba. I support the committee with research.
Good morning. My name is Sandra Boita. I'm leader of the opposition in Parliament. I'm very new here. You would know some of our former members because I know Mr. Seremani went to the Western Sahara when he took a delegation there. But he's away, Ms. Camara is away, Mr. Leon's away, so I will try my best to stand in for them.
Sandra Boita says that she's the leader of the party, meaning that she's actually the head of the opposition party in Parliament, the Democratic Alliance. So when you say the leader, sometimes it ends there, but she's actually the main person. So if in this meeting we could be able to persuade him to join the governing party, he would have been able to deliver the whole opposition to the governing party.
Kamal Fadel, the Polisario representative in Australia and the South Pacific region.
Good morning. My name is Sidi Omar, and I'm a member of the Polisario negotiating team with the United Nations. Just to say that I'm very glad to be here and to see some of the comrades that I had the pleasure to meet in the camp.
Good morning, Lara Swart. I'm from the Department of Foreign Affairs, North Africa Desk.
Good morning, my name is Nafi. I am working in the Sahrawi News Service as a journalist.
My name is Sukaina, and I'm working in the Western Sahara Philadelphia.
Good morning, I'm Mahfoud Ibrahim. I'm working for as a counselor in our embassy in Pretoria. I met some of our comrades here, but mainly during over the phone, a comrade in Eo, but I didn't know who was the one who missed the plane to Tifariti because I received many discussion about it, so I'm preparing a ticket.
You're not the only one that received that. I received that in South Africa, but I got the hot message of how they missed the plane and all those things, and I was sitting at the home saying, but what can I do? I'm in Algeria, I'm here, I can't do anything. And but comrades, we are all yours. What we thought we'll do this morning is just to go through as you know, that the ANC came into power through the elections in 1994, and since then we've been trying to transform South African society to what we regard to be a society that all its citizens will be equal, having come back from a struggle that inequality was part of the societal norm. You had to do a number of amendments. If you speak to South Africans across the board, others will tell you that we have achieved that. If you speak to ANC, will say that we have not achieved that, because 10 years to build in a sense of equality, you might have changed certain laws, but then you have to change the whole system, how it functions, the mindset of people, how they think about the next person. So there are a number of other issues that have come into it. However, we believe that we've made tremendous progress, and we believe that we have a responsibility to play in the continent. You'll see that we've continuously got ourselves engaged into negotiations, into peace building in the continent, because we believe that our own survival as a country, our own prosperity as a country, depends on the continent that we live in. And therefore, we have a responsibility to make sure that we contribute in building a continent that is sustainable, a continent that is at peace with itself, a continent that will be able to provide security for all, because we believe that without us doing that, our own democracy is at stake, because it will be challenged by a number of things. You'll have read that recently we've been hit by issues of xenophobia violence, and therefore that points to the very correctness of the decision we've made, that it doesn't help us to try and build and close South Africa that will be immune from what happens to our regime, because it will then follow you through to your own country. So the best thing is for us to go out there and put our shoulders on the wheel to make sure that we move the continent in a direction that all of us can live in security and we can live in peace. We've been involved in negotiations in Zimbabwe, and we are hoping that the Zimbabwe situation will then improve and make sure that the Zimbabwe situation is resolved once and for all. There are technical issues that are remaining, particularly in terms of how the peace process is the distribution basis of responsibilities within government. But we are quite confident that that matter will be resolved very soon. We've been involved in issues in Burundi, we are involved in issues in the DRC, and we continue to make sure that we play our role. When we're in Western Sahara, we saw the pieces of artillery that the previous apartheid government contributed to Morocco. And we're looking at it, and one colleague that I was with asked me that what do we do, given the fact that the pieces of artillery were given to Morocco? Are we going to give the same thing to Polisario? And I said, don't ask me difficult questions. Let me just go through the museum. We'll answer that when we go home. I never answered that question. I have no intention to answer that question, but it's quite a difficult question. Given the fact that we committed ourselves to contribute in a peaceful resolution of conflict, and therefore we think that we'll then be able to contribute in such a way that we bring Morocco to realize that the implementation of the UN resolution is in fact also in their own benefit, because at least they can go to bed and sleep with peace. Until that happens, they themselves, they are not at peace. It's a society in conflict. It's a society that does what pretends that in fact it can live in peace on one side, but on another side it can continue the war, and they cannot sustain that. Irrespective of the fact that they get support from France and Spain, that's not sustainable in the long term. And the fact that those countries, they themselves, had to be driven out of the countries in the continent, they will at some point accept the fact that they cannot continue to pop up and their surrogates in that part of the world. We were in Israel. We went to see Israel and Palestine, and of course the Israel government refused to meet with us because they felt that we were going to meet terrorists in Gaza, and we took a decision ourselves that we will not be given conditions, and therefore we are going to go to Gaza. But what is interesting in the debate, when we met what we call a South African lobby group, a South African Jewish lobby group, when we're engaging with them and we're discussing about the conflict in Israel and Palestine, and one of them said, "No, but you know, I'm very surprised why the Arab countries don't resolve this problem." And we said, "What do you mean?" He says, "No, but you know, there's a land next to Morocco there that is all the Palestinians could be moved there." And I said, "But that's a land of Western Sahara. That's Western Sahara." He said, "Yeah, no, they can be moved there and they can sit there and leave us in peace." That tells you how the mentality of those who grew up in an environment where they've been always told that you have a right to be in power, you have a right to dominate over others. They are able to find solutions for other people, and in fact, they are prepared to even move their own problem to somebody else. And it was quite an interesting, and when we went out of that meeting, said, "But is this guy serious? Is he thinking very serious of what he's saying?" But you can see that in their view, Morocco is a friend to them, and therefore they can shift the problem somewhere else. And that's why they will be able to do that, and that's why they think they'll be able to do that. But we continue to make sure that we engage ourselves with that part of the world, albeit all the difficulties that are there, and we want to stay steadfast in our support for the Western Sahara. You know that it has brought us into a coalition with the Moroccan authorities when we recognized Polisario, and they felt that we've taken a step that is not palatable. And I remember that we also attempted as a committee to engage them because we wanted to visit Morocco. And they came back to us to say that they wanted to escort us. They are prepared to host us, but they would want to escort us to occupied territories. We said, no, we want to go on our own. They said, no, there's a security problem. We said, we do not believe that the Western Sahara will do us harm. We can go on our own. In fact, we face a threat when the security forces accompanying us. But if we go on our own, they will realize themselves that they have no reason to attack us because it won't benefit anyone. They refused. So we could not go to Morocco because we could not agree on the escort part. Because we felt that if we were to agree with that part condition, that would have meant that when we arrived there, we could not engage with comrades openly. They would not have been able to engage with us openly because we'll be carrying a burden right from the onset. And that was the last meeting that the last ambassador came to see me, and basically that was the situation. But I want to demonstrate the fact that we've taken a principled decision that in whatever engagements we engage in, we will resist any temptation for the next person to say to us, you can turn left and not turn right, when we believe that engaging all parties and giving the respect to all parties equally, it's a principle that should not be compromised by conditions or placed by another party. Mm-hmm. So I want to say to you, comrades, you've come to your comrades, you've come to friends, and we'll continue to support the struggle in Western Sahara. I know that the question of the referendum remains quite a challenge, and there are a number of issues that comes into it, and there are a number of issues that always obstacles get thrown up. Every time we make 2 steps backward, Morocco takes 10 steps backward because they have one thing or the other that they don't want to do. As to how the struggle should continue, when we're in a conference, we listened very carefully to what the president was saying. And we listened and we came back and we said to our leadership, we think that we need to intensify how we engage Morocco because we think that if we do not do that, we might be heading for difficulties in that part of the world. And we believe that we'll be able to deal with some of the issues. We have been here at home. You have picked up in a number of the media that the ANC itself is taking some strain and the ANC itself is going through some difficulties. But we are determined and we are confident that these are challenges of any revolutionary movement that exists, that has existed in history. At a particular point in time, it faces its own problems. But we think that the organization is still intact and that will not compromise our relationship with all the other liberation movements that existed. And in fact, our commitment to support those who are oppressed will continue to do that. And that the challenges that we are facing currently, we think that is a storm in the teacup, which will go away at some point and will continue. And of course, we are quite confident. Arrogantly so, somebody once said in one conference that I speak with arrogance. And maybe put it that way, if I was to borrow from him, that we will win elections come next year. We will win elections. And I think the leader of the opposition, Sandra, accepts that she will increase the numbers, she will increase the percentage, but then the ANC will win. The elections might increase the percentage, but the ANC will win the elections. We are determined to do our work to continue to win the elections. And therefore, if the ANC is still a governing party, it means that the Western Sahara question will always remain on our conscience, on our agenda. And if you look at the ANC conference resolution, you will see that we have taken specific resolutions on what the ANC as a party should do in pursuit of the Western Sahara. So basically I've tried to, in a short space of time, give the tasks that are before us and the difficulties that as a movement we are facing, and the difficult decisions that we have to make as a country. But we are determined that we will succeed. We will succeed, and I think that will make South Africa a better place to live in. And I think that will make the continent a better continent for all of us to live in. When, of course, the last colony is also freed. Because without that freedom of the colony, the struggle of decolonization is not complete. We always make mistakes and say that we have decolonized the continent. But once one part of the continent is still under colonization, I think we must accept that the struggle for decolonization has not been completed. And we need to start raising that element within our structures, within the AU. Because I know that within the AU we hold different views. But I think we should accept the fact that those of us who agree, we should continue to agitate the fact that, in fact, the decolonization project has not been completed, and that the AU has to look at the continued decolonization of the continent. The challenge also for the continent is that once you deal with those aspects, you have to deal with other issues that come up with the relationship between ourselves and our former colonizers in a form of economic partnership agreement, that they continue to make sure that they decolonize us politically, but they colonize us economically, so that we should have a perpetual dependence to Europe, and make sure that all our trade arrangements with any other person should be subject to the trade arrangement with the EU. So I think that those are some of the issues that we need to continue to struggle against, and are the issues that we need to continue to build a unity amongst our people in the continent to make sure that we resist any temptation to be recolonized again. Comrades, we are in your hands now. As I said, that I've used the word comrades because I understand that even Sandra Porter will not be be offended with that, because we understand that it's used in a manner that it actually means friends, and it means that we are committed to make sure that at least that part of the world is given the attention, not only by the governing party, but by the whole South Africans, because it means that it will not all of us be free until Western Sahara is freed from colonization. Whether the colonizer is a person in our continent or is a person outside, so long as one part of our body is colonized, we will not be free as a people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to all of you. Thank you for the welcoming words, but also for the reaffirmation on your part and the democratic alliance that you represent of the principled position of support for the struggle of the Sahrawi people, a position for which we are very appreciated. We understand also that there's a consensus within the parliament when it comes to the question of Western Sahara, because it's not unfamiliar or alien to the South Africans who have gone through a long and arduous struggle for their freedom. What we would like to do, just to give you a brief on the latest development, I'm aware that many of you who work in this committee are familiar with how the question of Western Sahara has developed over the last years. But just let me give you a brief on the latest developments within the time limit that we have. And to do that, I'll go back a little bit in history by starting with the UN involvement in the process. As you may be aware, in early 80s, the situation on the ground was getting more difficult for Morocco, especially after building the defensive walls, which are still there, dividing the territory in two. But that whole situation that was unfolding in the ground led, by the beginning of the 90s, to an engagement by the United Nations. The result of that engagement was an agreement by both Morocco and the Polisario
on a peace plan to put an end to this conflict. That peace plan, as you may be aware, included among its main elements a referendum to be held, in which the Sahrawis would be asked to choose between independence or integration with Morocco, a ceasefire to put an end to the hostilities as the first step towards the referendum. The main issue that was settled by agreement and sanctioned by the United Nations was the fact that the Sahrawis would be identified on the basis of the last census, which the Spanish authorities undertook in the territory. That was the agreement. It was officially accepted by both parties and approved by the Security Council of the United Nations. From there, 91, ceasefire came into effect. 94, we started the identification process. But a few years after that, the whole process was stalled for one simple reason. The Moroccans were not happy about how the process was developing and insisted on including many, many thousands of Moroccan settlers and even those living in Morocco into actually the voting rolls, with the clear purpose of trying to tip the balance in their favor. That brought the process to a stalemate, which was unblocked by the intervention by the former U.S. Secretary of State, James Baker, that you may be aware of his intervention. And what Baker did was to use his leverage as a former American diplomat to push the two parties to an agreement, which was signed in 1797. The Houston Agreement. The Houston Agreement helped to some extent the UN Identification Commission to come up by January 2000 of the preliminary list of voters, which was very crucial for the whole process. That list was more or less the same number, came up with the same number that was included in the Spanish census. A year before that, I have to note that there was a change on the helm of the Moroccan kingdom. A new young king came to power after his father passed away in summer 99. So with this list, the next step was obviously to hold the referendum. We have the list. And then the next step was to hold the referendum. It was at that moment that Morocco decided to disengage from the whole process. And by 2004, Morocco actually officially notified the United Nations of its element and acceptance of any referendum that would include independence as an option. That was April 2004, Morocco's official declaration of not or being unwilling to engage in any process that would include independence as an option. Of course, this is contradictory, as you may see, to the whole previous engagement or commitment on Morocco's part. But that was the... What was the reason for that? Because, as any elections or referendum, you know, the crucial element is the electorate. So you just tell me who's going to vote, and I may tell you who's going to win. You've already indicated to the outcome of the coming election in South Africa on the basis of that. The electorate, this is the overwhelming majority will wish for this, so that is going to happen. Unfortunately, and this is a fact, the United Nations, which is in charge of the issue, did not do anything. And in June 2004, Baker resigned. Now, his departure left a process stalled, but also gave a chance to Morocco and Morocco's allies in the Security Council, mainly France, to try to come up with this so-called third way and try to convince everybody, South Africa probably included, that a referendum with two opposing options was not feasible, because it would lead to the so-called the winner's takes all. So, in their own logic, there was a need to look for a third way, a middle ground between independence and integration. That was the position that was circulating in the Security Council of the United Nations. But the United Nations was not doing anything. So, as a reaction to this, in summer 2005, the Sahrawis and the occupied territories revolted and started an uprising described by some as the Sahrawi Intifada for Independence. against the Moroccan occupation, to which the Moroccans reacted very brutally. And there are many reports by international, credible international organizations of the tremendous suffering under which the Sahrawis in the occupied territories have to live. And unfortunately, the United Nations didn't do anything. But with the message, both to Morocco and to the United Nations, that 30 years of oppression did not affect the will of the Sahrawis, both in the refugee camps and the occupied territories, to go on their struggle. As a result of that, the United Nations tried to do something by appointing a new personal envoy in May 2005, the former Dutch ambassador, Peter van Walsum, that you may have heard about, especially because of his statement last year. Now, when Peter van Walsum came to the region in October 2005, went back to the Security Council, in a briefing in January 2006, and gave his assessment of the situation, which is as follows. On the one hand, Morocco is still adamant on not accepting any referendum that would include independence, and that at that time they were contemplating a solution based on autonomy to be granted to Western Sahara, but within Moroccan sovereignty. That was in Walsum's assessment of the position of Morocco. On the other hand, the Polisario Front was strongly attached to the implementation of either the peace plan, which was approved by the Security Council, or the Dayton plan, which came later on in 2003, because these were the two peace plans that were either approved or supported by the Security Council. The third element, conclusion of Walsum, is that the Security Council was not willing to impose a non-consensual solution. And that's why it actually did not do anything or react when Morocco rejected the settlement plan. As in final conclusion of his own assessment, there were only two options. Prolongation of the stalemate, which he did not favor, as it may be a recipe, as he said, for violence, or the engagement on the part of the two parties in direct negotiations without preconditions, with the aim or the purpose of achieving a solution, mutually acceptable solution, but one that will provide for the self-determination of the people of Western Sahara. That was in January 2006. That whole year witnessed a new and strengthened campaign on Moroccan side propagating to this so-called autonomy plan, where delegations were dispatched to the fourth corner of the world, explaining the Moroccan initiative of granting this autonomy to Western Sahara, which was widely described by them as a compromise, a realist compromise to sort out the solution. In April last year, Morocco finally submitted a proposal to the United Nations, but that was preceded by another proposal by the Polisario Front. So what is this Moroccan? And I've already heard that a comrade speaking about meeting with a Moroccan delegation and raising the issue for the fact. What is Morocco's proposal about? First of all, it departs from the premise or the understanding that Western Sahara is already part of Morocco, and therefore Morocco can grant autonomy to this part of so-called Morocco. And second, once that is settled, Morocco would be willing to delegate some of local competences to this new authority. And that will be sanctioned, the whole package, by a referendum to gauge the certain the will of the Sahrawis. That's more or less with the Moroccan proposal. But as you can see, it's based on a faulty premise. The final status of Western Sahara has not been settled yet. No country in the world has recognized Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. And therefore, it is completely unfounded. On the other hand, the proposal that the Polisario submitted to the United Nations was a very realist proposal, because it is based on two main pillars. The first is that we will go to the referendum as called for by the United Nations. Whatever the outcome of the referendum, we will accept as a Polisario and as a Sahrawi. But that should be a free, fair, internationally monitored referendum. But should that referendum lead to independence, something which we've been fighting for many years, we would be willing to establish very privileged relations with Morocco in all domains and areas of mutual interest, and even those who may be, who are and may be concerned for their, our Moroccan neighbors in terms of security, joint commercial and trade ventures, and even to the extent of conceding granting nationality to those Moroccans who will wish or desire to reside in Western Sahara. That was our proposal, and as a gesture of goodwill, to search and look for a sustainable, peaceful, and lasting solution to this problem. Both proposals were taken on board by the Security Council, and then the Security Council in April 2007 passed a resolution calling on us, the Polisario and Morocco, to engage in negotiations, direct negotiations without preconditions. In summer 2007, we started the first round, and then the second round. Early this year, we did held the third and fourth rounds of negotiations. In a nutshell, during this four rounds of negotiations, in which I personally took part, we couldn't get to any tangible result for a simple reason. The Moroccan delegation has always insisted on discussing exclusively their own proposal. And bear in mind that the Security Council is calling for a negotiation without preconditions. But this is, in a very simple way, this is the Moroccan decision. Now, that for us is a non-starter for any negotiations. They have to be open negotiations in which that proposal can even be discussed by along with our proposal. Because our position is this. Autonomy is one of the options that could lead or could be the outcome of a referendum. So we have no problem in principle of including autonomy as one of the many options to be given to the Sahrawi to decide. But giving the Sahrawi only one option is actually a choice between autonomy and autonomy. So you are just voting for yes or yes. This is obviously unacceptable, neither for the Sahrawis and neither for many around the world, including your country. Now, this is now the situation on the ground. We've started the process of negotiation, but unfortunately you haven't been able to get to any solution. From our side as Polisario, we believe that this is the right way, and this is actually the only way to reach a mutually acceptable settlement. It is the way of negotiations. But the problem in these negotiations is that, and unlike the process of negotiation that you had to go through here in this country, there was at least a mutual recognition on two parties that there is a major problem that we need to be solved. And there was also recognition that there are, that the other party implicated in this process and he or she has a contribution. In the case of Morocco, there's only for them, their party, their proposal, and we from our side have to accept it. And as I've already said, this is something unacceptable to us. So now, what are the prospects? We're waiting for a new person and envoy to be officially appointed, because we already have a name for the U.S. Ambassador Christopher Ross, and I think within the few coming months, if not days, his name will be officially announced. And that will be possibly followed by a fifth round of negotiations. So in brief, you've already mentioned, Chair, the difficult times that people, struggling people, sometimes go through, and I will tell you, these are difficult times when it comes to the Sahrawi people's struggle for self-determination, because the occupiers still occupying the territory, oppressing our people who are living there, exploiting our natural resources, while at the same time we have the other refugee communities that many of you had the chance to visit, going through a very difficult situation for the last 30 years. And the international situation, particularly the support that Morocco is getting from countries like the United States and France, is making things difficult. So they indeed, very difficult times for us. But, and as you also mentioned, we as Sahrawis still have that strong determination and will to continue and carry on our struggle for freedom. And we draw inspiration from your struggle and many struggles around the world, because however times may be difficult, the will of the people always prevails. That's in brief a background to the latest development of the question of Western Sahara. Once again, I would like to thank you very much. Thank all comrades and friends here present with us for their interest. And we'll be very delighted to engage with you in discussing issues both relating to Western Sahara but also to your own experience, because we're also here to learn from your struggle but also from your nation state building project, particularly the parliamentarian experience. And with me, as they have already introduced themselves, senior officials from the Sahara Republic will also be very delighted, I'm sure, to engage with you in this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable members, I invite you to comment and to ask questions and to make contributions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the input. I'm a member of parliament, but sometimes I think like a mother and a woman and a wife. And listening to the input, I'm asking myself certain questions which maybe you might help me in answering them. And also taking lessons from our own experience at South Africa. I know the chairperson in the opening remarks spoke about other people feeling superior than others, all those issues. Now the question that comes into my mind is, what makes it difficult for the Moroccans to coexist with the Western Saharans? What is their main problem in accepting that coexistence with the Western Sahara? Now, the second question also that I have is that, you know, there are a lot of organizations, NGOs, that play a very important role. And, you know, just citing an example, recently, you might have seen the Oxfam presenting a report in the UN about South African situation. Now I'm asking myself, are there any NGOs or international organizations, humanitarian organizations, that are playing that kind of role in Western Sahara so that the issues of Western Sahara can remain in the agenda wherever there is an international forum? Those are the two questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I indicated earlier on, that I had an occasion to speak to a Moroccan delegation in Geneva. We were discussing other matters, and then the question of Western Sahara arose. Firstly, they told us of their disappointment of South Africa's attitude and position in all international forums of supporting your cause, a cause they believe is non-existent, and that in fact our voice is a solo voice, because North Africa understand the issues much better, and they are not in support of your cause. In the world, as they indicated, there are only two countries that are neighbors and whose borders are closed, and that is Morocco and Algeria. And the reason for that is because Algeria is giving them difficulties because they have the largest Western Sahara people in their own territory. And some of your people are in Libya and elsewhere that spread around the region. They cannot think of any region, any country in that region that does not have your people. Now, people do not understand why independence is only seeked by those people in Morocco. And they're not seeking independence in Algeria, they're not seeking independence those who are in Libya, they're not seeking independence those who are elsewhere. In those territories they occupy, they've been there for, they're indigenous in those countries. So why are they not seeking independence there? And that, in fact, you and them are the same people in all respects. So there's no distinction, actually. So in other words, your cause is baseless. And persuading us to really rethink our position. And because they would like to reconnect with us in South Africa as an important economy in Africa, and pursue our friendship, which they had with President Mandela, and unfortunately broke because of this attitude we have towards you. So they were making all these statements and inviting us. Interestingly, they did not know what we were already there. I don't know if they knew. But they were inviting us to go and see for ourselves in Western Sahara that there's no such thing as called Western Sahara. When we are on the ground, we shall see that, in fact, there's no country like that. And if we need resources and so on to undertake this project, they are available to help. So I'm just updating you, not because I believe in what they're saying, so that we can all together engage these issues. And perhaps they will help us to even understand much broader the issues, because the more you understand the other side, the better as to what their arguments are. I know that you are not hearing this for the first time. Thank you.
Thank you. The report talks much about the engagement of the Sahrawi with the United Nations and quite a number of agreements and resolutions that came into being. Having listened to Honorable Mataza and North Africa's attitude from the side of the Moroccans, I personally have an observation that you would help me tell whether the observation is myopic or not. The African Union has replaced the Organization of African Unity, and on a number of occasions the African Union has been meeting, set up missions and so on and so forth, peacekeeping and whatever you might call it. But recently you look at the Zimbabwean problem that the chair spoke to, and Zimbabwe is on the news, more particularly on the basis of what their opposition leaders are doing about the situation in Zimbabwe and so on and so forth. My observation is the Polisario are taking a lukewarm approach to the struggle of the Sahrawi. I'm saying that is my observation because outside of North Africa, I personally haven't heard the Polisario Front taking the AU into task about the situation in Morocco. Now, I'm wondering what accounts for that. Of course, I'm mindful of the fact that you're saying you have been engaging with the United Nations, and you have highlighted problems that resulted into some of the Baker, for example, resigning. But my observation has always been that in most issues that the AU attends to, I've never heard that vociferous attitude from the Polisario that says put our issue on the agenda. That is my observation, and I'm not so sure what accounts for that. Particularly when you look at that what is just happening next door in Zimbabwe, there's been election and so on and so forth. But we have an MTC that troopers around the world and saying the issue of Zimbabwe must be resolved by hook or crook. Yet an issue that has been with us for quite some time, to me appears to just been approached from a point of view of, from the side of the Sahrawi. Tell me if my observation is wrong. But let me also understand why does it seem that you are very apologetic about the liberation of your people. I'm saying apologetic because one of the reasons why South Africa as a country came to be the struggle in South Africa came to be recognized in this fashion was that the leadership of the ANC was knocking at every door, whether welcomed or not, and you were part of those trenches. Now, that is my observation. Talk to me about that observation and tell me whether I'm myopic or not. Still within the African Union, to what extent have you also been a thorn within the region? In the same way as your recent MTC is a thorn in SADC. Whether somebody wants to listen to him or not, maybe depending on the kind of resources that they have, but you would see Changarai almost everywhere. I don't see that with the Polisario Front. Whether the doors in North Africa are opened or not, I tend not to see that. Is the observation mistaken? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll address myself to the Omar presentation, and then it may put me in a better position to really perhaps ask a question or comment. It's just that after you have clarified what I'm going to ask you now, in your presentation, I didn't quite get it clearly where the latest where the difficulties are, what the latest negotiations are about. Are they about the referendum or about independence, and is that where the difficulty is, or are they about something else which is in between? I didn't quite get that, where the difficulty is with regard to the negotiations now at the present moment between you and the Mauritanians, which I got that they are UN sanctioned. So perhaps if I can just get that clarified, I'll be able to formulate the question that I'd like to ask.
Well, I just have to say that in talking to you about the latest developments, there are lots of things going on, and to understand that, I may have needed an hour, like more or less. What we're about now, when Morocco rejected all these plans, all plans that we had agreed, the United Nations started changing its approach, and instead of calling for a referendum to be held under the UN auspices, is now calling very strictly for a mutually acceptable political solution. These are the buzzwords. And that was what I said by sanctioned by the Security Council on 3rd 30th April 2007, the Security Council took for the first time in the history of the conflict a resolution calling for negotiations. So the negotiations are about the Polisario and Morocco discussing, negotiating, and hopefully reaching a mutually acceptable political solution. What that solution would be, in the Security Council's view, it's up to the parties. Which is, as you can see, it's something which we don't understand. Because it is a problem, a decolonization problem, as the United Nations considers, and the Security Council, as the main body of the UN, has a responsibility. So it's not about the parties to achieve a solution, which is desirable, but it's for the Security Council also to make sure that that solution is framed within the context of international legality. But unfortunately, this is what the main powers, France and the US, in the Security Council are calling for. Only a solution to be worked out between us and the Moroccans. Morocco, and that's what I'm talking, Morocco has a proposal. They think this is the solution. We have a proposal, and we do believe that's the realist and solution that could lead to this mutually acceptable solution. But that's all what the negotiation is about. It's to work out this mutually acceptable political solution. I hope that is, to some extent, clarifies your query. Thank you, all of you, for that question. And let me start by the question of coexistence between the Moroccans and the Sahrawis, by saying that, in fact, there's no problem between the Sahrawis and the Moroccans, even because of the geography, in the sense that it's not like what you had here, the oppressors and the oppressed living on the same land, to some extent like in Palestine. But the problem, as it's rude, it is a regime-created problem created by the regime in Morocco in the early 70s. And this is because of many historical factors that I will not get into in Morocco. Morocco got its independence in 56. It was a negotiated independence between the monarchy and France. That led to many people unhappy in Morocco, especially the nationalists, who were hoping for a democratic, actually, republic in Morocco. That was reflected in a series of riots of 71, 72, the two main coups against the king himself, the first coups in the history of Morocco. And at that time, and because of the mounting economic and social problems, the kingdom was looking for an outlet for that problem, with the Sahrawis next door. And it was about to be decolonized by Spain. And then that's where the Green March started, the war and everything. So it's a regime-created problem, a problem that... And because of the complexity of the issue, it has actually been inextricably linked to the existence of the monarchy in Morocco. So we don't have any problem with the Moroccans, and we can coexist. And this is what I was mentioning in the proposal that we submitted to the United Nations. We would be very willing even to allow the Moroccans, many Moroccans who are now settling in Western Sahara, to acquire a Sahrawi nationality in future independent Western Sahara. But of course, that would be on the condition that we will not be a minority in our country. Yeah, so that's when it comes to the coexistence issue. There are many NGOs, international and regional, working to raise awareness about the issues. There are many around this world. Now, just a short comment on the comrades about his meeting with the Moroccans. There are many fallacies and half-truths and even lies in what they... the fact that the Sahrawis are dispersed all around the Maghreb. This is not true. We have a very small population to be dispersed as long. And the fact that it's not... the issue does not exist. The issue that it doesn't exist, probably in their own minds, at least everybody knows what is happening in that region. Now, to feel disappointed or not
as to the South African position. I think the South Africans can talk about themselves, but my own understanding and my belief that South Africa is a sovereign country, and it takes the decision that it pleases. A comment about the lockwork approach pursued by the Polisario when it comes to international forums, and particularly the African Union, and why it's only that with by the United Nations. Just to tell you that the issue of Western Sahara was first discussed within the Organization of African Unity. And that's when, even before this, ADR became a member of the Organization of African Unity. And it was on the basis of a resolution taken by the then OAU that the United Nations started its engagement in the territory. Now, to put it in the broader context, the same time that the OAU was being established, the United Nations was already considering the issue of Western Sahara as a decolonization issue in 63. And that's where the legal context of understanding this issue. It is a decolonization issue dealt with by a specific commission in the UN system, which is the Fourth Commission. When the war broke out in 1975, it became an issue of international security, which is the competence of the Security Council. And that's why it sits on by the Security Council. So these are the two overlapping contexts in which to understand the issue of Western Sahara. So it's not that the OEU is not there or being sidelined. This is an international conflict. And there, these are the structures. This doesn't, of course, mean that we are not active at the level of the EU. We are one of the founding members of the African Union. And we're present in all these institutions related to the parliament. So, this, I think, I hope that this clarification to some extent gives you some
shed light to the query that you have.
And my colleagues have any comments on this?
Thank you very much. It is my sense that it is my sense that the mutually acceptable solution of the suggested by the United Nations seems to be difficult. That is my sense. Now, if that is the case, because it seems that you and the Moroccan are far apart, Now, if that is correct and that is the case, do you see any chance that could produce any result at all to take your struggle forward following that particular route? And if not, then what do you think, needs to be done? Now, I just want to add to that the fact that, one visited there. It helped one because we saw the conditions, in the camps, the conditions where people are living there, which are totally, difficult and really very, 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 very. To think that people can live like that for decades and decades and decades is incomprehensible, It's difficult for anyone to imagine that people can live like that unless you go and see it and then you're just shocked. Now, this then creates, what one seemed to pick up there was that it does create some impatience, amongst some other, people there in your struggle. There would be people who are utterly and utterly impatient because they just don't see, a way forward and would like to go back now, to the
you know, to intensify the armed struggle as perhaps the only logical. There's some frustration. So that being the case, and you know, this is what one really did seem to pick up in some circles. What now then do you think that is the, you know, is a viable way for to take things forward, in which we can also, you know, as South Africa, say that this is where we center around, because this is the direction in which our support is required. Thank you very much.
The context I understand, the struggle for liberation in Western Sahara is one of the oldest. My point of departure is that I personally see the approach of the Polisario Front as being a gentleman's approach to a liberation struggle, which then says to me, to a large extent, that gentleman's approach presupposes that any other person who does not feel pressure would not therefore act in a way that would say, let's resolve the issue. I'm using Tsvangirai as a simple example, because the struggle, the issue of MDC is just recent, it's nascent, compared to what is the struggle for the liberation of the Sahrawi people. And I'm saying it barely on the Polisario's footsteps, that I think one of the reasons that continues to delay the struggle for the liberation of the Sahrawi is that, this is my personal observation, to a large extent, I don't think we're pumping enough or we're making enough noise to whoever cares to listen or not, to then say, Africa shall not be free up until Western Sahara. And the gentleman approach that I'm speaking to, I don't disagree with the fact that yes, there is a need to engage in international fora when instruments have been provided, whether it be decolonization, whatever you might call it. But I'm saying, taking the cue from what this liberation movement in South Africa did collectively with yourselves, I personally feel that there's an off-ramp in terms of compelling the world to drum up support for the Polisario Front. That is my issue. I understand all of these legal instruments, but I'm saying it appears as if the Polisario Front has not taken the cue from the ANC to then say, if we used music, if we used any other thing to say to the world, here we are in Western Sahara. I don't feel that. That was my feature.
I'm going to go to Honorable Kalako, I'll come back to you. But to say that when I came to Parliament in 1999, I think the first ambassador that was there during that period came to see me in my office, and he said to me, "No, the militants of the ANC don't understand our relationship between the ANC and Morocco." I'm listening to my comrade. I said, it reminds me that ambassador when he says that the militants of the ANC don't understand the relationship. Honorable Kala.
Thank you, Jay. I'm sure the ambassador might not have been very much versed on how ANC really is serious about decolonization. But the question, just three questions. One is, what is the attitude of the Arab state on the issue between Polisario and Morocco around them? And secondly, I'm sure the comrade next to me, yeah, what is he trying to raise is, since you actually reached a stage where you have been able to cease hostilities between you and Morocco, I know Polisario Front, during the time which you have been fighting, in fact, some of your cadres who have been in same places in exile. I know when I was in Angola and when we had to move
some of us, some of our cadres, for further training. Some of your cadres, we did need them. So, to me, really, since we have been negotiating, there must be amongst whether the leadership of Polisario and your membership and people in the Western Sahara, because of how the UN have been even treating you, because it's clear the UN changes the goalposts to fit France, Spain, or the European interest on the issue. So, since there is that, and you have been persistent in actually trying to focus on negotiations, are there no forces within Western Sahara, within the people there who are not getting, who are getting impatient about this approach, who might be amongst themselves who are saying, no, look, let's go back to us. The other question is, no, to go back to the question of the maybe you may clarify it again, which was asked by my colleague here, on the attitude of Moroccans when they say, Polisario, I mean, Western Saharan people, Saharan people are all over, you know, the neighbors there. Why are they not demanding independence in those areas? Of course, you have just said there's no such thing, you are a small population. Are there no Western Saharan people who are in other countries? Because of war, of course, people will be displaced, who might be residing on the neighbors around there.
Oh, thank you, Chair. I just want to maybe ask about the instruments of influence in terms of engaging. I mean, if you look at a lot of conflicts this past 30, 40 years that was settled, it was maybe internal settlement, there was outside good offices, special representatives, you had even a quartet that's not working. So you've got a lot of examples of instruments. My question is, have you considered, or at this stage, of using alternative instruments or other good offices or other back channels or maybe new partners in taking your agenda forward? That's just a question. I mean, the conventional instruments, what is in the region, what is the positions of the countries in your region, and so on and so on. My question is there an effort to maybe look at alternative instruments at this stage?
Though my colleague here on the right has just touched the point I wanted to make, I'm a bit concerned because I know, I think one of the problems that the people are not assisting Western Sahara in the way that it's supposed to be, probably it is because of the oil. Now, definitely in looking at all those alternatives, what conditions are they putting on those countries that are getting oil from Western Sahara? Are they those countries politically, because they are benefiting economically from Western Sahara, what are they doing politically to support a Western Sahara so that they can get the political solution? And one of the issues, Chair, you know, I was looking at the countries that recognizes Western Sahara, just in follow-up to what my colleague was raising here. I think it is a concern for us, because when you look at the list, you realize that in many countries, Western Sahara had that energy of opening even embassies in different countries so that they can really spread the message about the independence of Western Sahara. I don't know whether in the closing of all those embassies in most countries, how are they keeping the spirit and those nations mobilized so that they can support what is going on in the Western Sahara. I must say, Chair, my question is because I am concerned that the Western Sahara people must not have this fatigue now of fighting and continuing with their struggle. it is very, very important to keep those spirits moving and on the other side negotiating and finding a solution. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Chairperson, and all of the members of Parliament. We are here on a study tour, and we have been invited to South Africa. We've been here for some time, and we are partly students to learn and be inspired, and hopefully that inspiration will deal with that possibility of fatigue. But part of our program is that we have visited the cradle of humankind, and so we felt we are coming back home, and it is what a wonderful home to come back to. We have received a lot of warmth, friendship, understanding, and sympathy and solidarity. It's been wonderful to be here. And myself and my colleagues are really grateful for the opportunity to be here in South Africa. And we thank very much the Lara and her team and the Department of Foreign Affairs for the kind invitation. We're still here. We're going to be here for more time, and we're going to KwaZulu-Natal tomorrow, and we're looking forward to that visit too. There have been quite a few questions, and I would like that we could have had the opportunity to respond to every question when it arose, because dealing with so many questions may not give justice to all those the issues raised. But the way that the questions have been asked is indicative of where we are and what kind of audience we have here. These are friends, and they want to know, and they are very clear with us, open, and this is really something wonderful which I am not used to. When I go to speak to the Foreign Affairs Committee in Australia, I can tell you it is a different way, and this is really moving for us to have such friends here. I will attempt to briefly, hopefully, respond to some of these questions that have been raised. There is no need to go into the history of the relationship between Polisario and the ANC. You are very well aware of that. But what I can tell you, we have also been really delighted to hear that the Western Sahara issue in South Africa is not an ANC issue. It enjoys the support and understanding and solidarity of all the parties in South Africa. And that is tremendous for us, because this is the case. Why? In many other parts of the world, because it is a just cause. And a just cause always obtains and receives the support of all the parties. It's a bipartisan issue. And that needs to be taken into account. The chairperson raised the issue of the fear of the miraculous of a solution. And I think he raised a very important issue, because that fear is the obstacle. The fear of the unknown, the fear of the other, and the fear of peace. Because this monarchy in Morocco is sitting on a volcano, and to cling to the Western Sahara issue is a way to avoid perhaps the inevitable. That is reform in Morocco itself, democracy, respect of the human rights. So that fear is a big problem. We need to find a way to overcome that fear, which is in the monarchy, in the regime, and amongst those who benefit from the current situation in Western Sahara. We have tried from our side to provide ways and means of tackling that fear by telling our friends and neighbors in Morocco that a solution, a peaceful, a just solution in Western Sahara is going to be of benefit to the Moroccan people, to the monarchy, and to its allies and friends in the West. Why? Because it will create an atmosphere of peace, progress, stability, and it will end the crazy way of spending millions of dollars for nothing, for an occupation which will end eventually in the future. Morocco today spends $2 to $3 million on a daily basis to maintain 140,000 soldiers along the wall, the sand wall, the berg that they have built there, with 3 to 5 million landmines, with dogs, radars, rocks, trenches, because that is also an indication of how fearful they are from a small people, that we don't have those means, but yet they have spent a huge amount on what probably can be described as a white elephant. So we're telling them, stop this craziness, let us go to peace. Let us, you know, give a chance to the Sahrawi people to decide their own future, and we will defend. And I think your experience in reconciliation is a very tremendous experiment in reconciliation, but also is an inspiration to all of us, and should be an inspiration to our friends in Morocco, hopefully. So when you meet them next time, please talk to them about reconciliation and peace and solution, peaceful solutions of conflict. And I go back to that meeting, because that is a very important question there about what the Moroccans are saying. It's not only South Africa that has taken a positive position and principled ethical position on West Sahara. It is 85 countries worldwide. It is the whole African Union that has taken a positive position on West Sahara. It is, you know, thousands of people in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia, in Australia, where I am based, who said that this is a just cause, this is an issue that deserves support, and an issue that is, you know, these people have a right to self-determination. So to say that there are only few countries, Algeria and South Africa, is wrong. Algeria, and you mentioned that they told you about Algeria, is closing its border with Morocco, not allowing, you know, the peaceful solution that they are taking the Sahrawis there on their land. Algeria, as you know, hosted the ANC, hosted Mr. Mandela for a long time. They supported Mozambique, they supported Zimbabwe, they supported Eritrea, they supported Namibia, they supported East Timor. It used to be called in the 60s and the 70s the Mecca of the revolutionaries. I think you probably have heard this phrase. So it is to support all these countries in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and not to support a small people on their border would be a big contradiction, and no one will understand it. So Algeria never wanted a part of Western Sahara or anything. They said, we have gone through our independence cycle, our liberation struggle, we cannot but support this neighbor, because we can see it is injustice that they were bombarded with napalm, cluster bombs, and they needed a safe haven to move from these bombardments to the southwest of Algeria, and they did allow the refugees to stay there. What did they give in the beginning? It's medicine, food, not arms. That came later, but also they gave that to other people. So Algeria does not want a part of Western Sahara. It's not like Morocco or Mauritania. They said, we will support the Sahrawi people, we will give them, you know, humanitarian assistance and political and moral support. So that is another, you know, misconception and a lie. Sahrawis, yes, they are everywhere, probably. Let's say they are everywhere, which is not the truth, but let's say. But the Irish are in America, the Zimbabweans are in South Africa. You know, this does not mean that they should demand independence here in South Africa. Or if the Zimbabweans or Malawi people say,
we want a referendum in South Africa, it doesn't make any sense. So, Sahrawis maybe in Libya, in Mauritania, in, but they are perhaps refugees, perhaps second generation of Sahrawis who are living there. Maybe they have the nationality. But if they want to come to Western Sahara and also prove that they want to be citizens of Western Sahara, that works. But let's go back to the International Court of Justice position on Western Sahara. They said that, and you go back and see the conclusion of the opinion, that there is a people. It was not terra nullis, Western Sahara. It had a people. And that people have a right to self-determination. Again, there is a Spanish census of 1974, which identified who are the Sahrawis. Now, it becomes maybe a political issue, a solution, that those people who are entitled to vote in the referendum, should, they are the ones who are who meant to participate. And there was a census, and people were identified, and Morocco again refused to go ahead to the referendum. But also, even now, we say that the settlers can stay, they can participate in the referendum. It's not a question of who is a Sahrawi or not. The Africa issue. I just deal with these two issues and let my other colleagues deal with other questions. But I thought these are very important issues. Why we're not so vocal? So, in the African Union, we thought this is our organization. Morocco's aim is to destroy the OAU and destroy the African Union because they couldn't be part of it. They want to destroy it. What should we do? Do we allow them to create this unity among African Union and destroy the organization? Or do we stay quiet, be wise, and allow at least the organization to survive? We could have said to our friends, boycott the AU summit. I give you an example that happened here in South Africa. When the Moroccans objected to the Polisario, they say they are attending the meeting of
NAF.
We could have insisted and said, yes, we want to be here, we want to talk about our independence, we have a right to be here, and we are not going. But when we realized that if we did that, there will be no meeting, there will be no progress, there will be no unity amongst our friends and brothers in Africa, we said we will abstain, we will not attend. Somebody else said, you are crazy, you have a right to be there. But it is wise, it is at least at that moment logical to allow things to move, but we have been very patient. And we can continue to be patient. Sometimes I'm one of the people, maybe the new generation, the young generation, who want to see things differently, who want to have action, who want maybe to start a war. But is that the right thing? Is that wise? And sometimes it doesn't work in our favor. Because why the media doesn't talk about us and you don't hear about us? Because we haven't, you know, undertaken terrorism action in Morocco. We didn't hijack planes, we did not kidnap people. But people want but the media wants to see blood. They want to see action. And it is very tempting sometimes to us who have been, you know, waiting, we have our people outside for 35 years to do these actions. But sometimes it is better not to do it and be patient. And hopefully you will understand that and you will continue to support us. And I think a friend in need is a friend indeed. Thank you.
Well, just to add to what our colleague Kamal said, I share the same views, and we do appreciate a lot the enthusiasm expressed by our comrades here and there. And we will tell them just keep on telling us the same words. To just try to answer your question. About the what the negotiations are about. And let me start by saying that we, as I said, from the Polisario, realize that there's no other way out of this conflict apart from negotiations. We fought 16 years
against the Moroccan forces. None of us could achieve a victory, a military victory. This is a fact that we both recognize. And that's why we embrace wholeheartedly the call by the Security Council to engage in negotiation. Not because it's only the Security Council, but because we believe this is the way out. But what is missing here is the will and good faith on the other side to engage in a serious negotiation leading to a solution that respects our national aspirations and our legitimate rights. That's now the problem. Morocco is a neighbor, and as the cliche would go on, we may change our friends or enemies, but we cannot change our neighbors. They are there, and they're there to stay. And we are aspiring for a friendly relationship with our North neighbors. But that could only be brought about by a negotiated settlement that, as I say, respects our legitimate rights to exist as a people. And when that's done, we're ready, as has been already emphasized, to establish very good and even privileged relations with our North neighbors. So this is what the negotiations are about. The question about the position of the Arab League. The simple answer is that we are not members of the Arab League because for many reasons, but one of them that key members actually of that league did join Morocco in the Green March to occupy our country. And because of a formula which is adopted by the League to work on a consensus basis, we will not be, it's difficult for us to even apply to remember that, but that's the position. And as my colleague has come out with saying, that's why the issue is more raised and embraced by the African Union as an African issue rather than as an Arab issue. Although we Sahrawis also would like always to say that we leave the Arab League to sort out the Palestinian issue. One issue is enough for them. And then if they have extra time, they can tackle the issue for the Sahara. Kamal has already spoken about this, the disappointment that someone said, the young generation, especially in the occupied territories. Yes, and it's a worrying fact that many of all those young people are now getting impatient and they want to take up arms again or engage in violent action. They do see what is happening in Palestine. They have access to Al Jazeera and others. They saw what makes news and what's happening in Iraq. And they know that if you want to be in the news, it's very simple. That's our attention. But we do hope that we will not be or find ourselves in that position. If we have thought of seeking other alternative instruments, you raised the question. And this is a very interesting, important question, because that could help to push the process forward. Baker was, although he was employed by the UN, but at least he gave that role or played that role of facilitator, because he could, with the leverage he had from the US administration, guarantee the solution, and that's why he came up with his plan. But the problem is that to find an alternative instrument to what's existing, we need finds on the other side. Because even before this process started, we had face-to-face meetings with the late King Hassan. That was outside the United Nations. That was our gesture to meet on that level, on that official level. But unfortunately, we haven't seen any signs from the other party to try even to look and seek another instrument that would be supporting the official UN channel. Thank you.
Honorable members, the delegation is scheduled to take it at 12 Parliament, and at 12 we have lunch, I'm told, in Mark's building with a delegation. There are some of the issues that people may want to pursue that they will then allow them to be pursued over lunch. But I just want to raise, in closing this meeting, to say that the questions that members were raising are questions that probably are informed by the approach that the ANC adopted when it executed the strike. They asked the question about other instruments, they asked the question about
finding a way to put pressure on other areas of power so that those pressures can move. And I just want to summarize those questions and put them in that particular perspective, that when the ANC was struggling in South Africa, it looked at the problem in South Africa and said, what is the best way for us to move the struggle in such a way that we are able to deal with a number of areas at a particular point in time and at a goal. And the ANC embarked in what it's called a program of mass mobilization, that you keep the masses organized, you keep the masses mobilized, and you keep the pressures into the enemy so that the enemy is unable to deal with that particular process. But you make sure that the masses are forever engaged in a struggle. There's no period of lull in that. And at the same time, alongside that, you then do your international work, mobilize the international community to support your cause, to make sure that you increase the pressure at the international level for the isolation of the apartheid regime and to make life difficult for the apartheid regime to survive. You see that in that period you had a number of anti-apartheid movement that developed during that period. You had a spot boycott, cultural boycott that has been put in at the international level. On one hand, you had what was called the underground work that needed to be done by the cadres of the movement to make sure that the masses stays organized. So you needed the infrastructure underground that would continuously provide the leadership and provide the impetus for the masses to stay mobilized. So another element that was put in was the underground work that needed to be done. And the last component, of course, was the armed struggle. So we used to call it the four pillars of the struggle. That's how that struggle was conceptualized. So that all these four pillars, it's not starting from one to go to second. They are all executed at the same time. They all move together at the same time. In doing so, you then put the regime into a crisis of not being able to manage. On one hand, it has a problem with the masses that are continuously engaging it. On another hand, it has the international environment that is not conducive for it. On one hand, you've got your armed cadres keeping pressure on it, and your underground political infrastructure, both political and military, are able to keep those pressures going. So in that context, it was difficult for the apartheid regime to be able to deal with the problem. And these questions that have been asked are asked informed by that particular perspective, that we should be looking at all different avenues of making sure that the struggle is executed in every space that we want. We keep all the space occupied. You do not allow the enemy to have any ground anywhere. So we keep ourselves occupied in all the spaces, and we leave no space to change. We should be there, we should be occupying that space, so that the enemy is forever pushed backward in all levels. All of these things were done in pursuit of an objective of a negotiated settlement. And when that prospect arose and when that prospect materialized, it was the ANC that suspended the armed struggle to say, comrades will not go on with the armed struggle. It was the ANC that says we should advance the process of lifting sanctions. Of course, this thing leads to the timing, when do you do them, when you don't do them. But it was the ANC that says, no, we should move towards this particular direction. It was the ANC that said, no, let's reduce the isolation of apartheid, because now we are taking power, we need South Africa to be reintegrated into the community of nations. But during the negotiations, it was understood by the ANC that the masses play the central role in making sure that the negotiations become a success. Hence, if you look at our period of negotiations, you'll hear President Mandela speaking about the rolling mass action. It was clear that the masses will be the only impetus. Having suspended your armed struggle, having suspended all those international boycotts, you still had to leave your underground to keep the masses involved throughout so they can put pressure to move the negotiations. So the masses did not become a standby to waiting for an outcome. They became part of the negotiations.
When negotiations stalled, the masses were able to push for that. When negotiations were going accordingly, the masses were there to say, this is what we want. This is what we are prepared to compromise on, but this is what we are not prepared to compromise on. And the masses will then be engaged in marches and all pickets and all those things so that they can put pressure to the political leadership, both of the apartheid regime and the democratic political leadership, to say that this is how far you can go when you compromise. This will not accept. And that allows the ANC to be able to say, yes, one, we can compromise. Two, our masses are saying no, we may not compromise on two. Three, we can work a workable solution. So in that process, masses became part of the negotiation process. And I'm saying these questions are asked with that understanding, that there should be, Polisario has to look at other means of making sure that we occupy the spaces that are there, that we do not allow the enemy to relax, and we do not allow the enemy to have a breather. They must be able to find themselves forever pushed on the corner. And that it means that international work has to be intensified in this particular context of the Polisario situation. International work has to be intensified to make sure that those of us who are in solidarity also increase our own engagement. We do not just pay lip service to solidarity, but we are engaged physically to say, what is it that we should do over and above making pronouncements of solidarity? And that should be the issue that we should be time to time and coming back to as a South African population, to say, yes, we are committed to solidarity, but what do we do beyond pronouncing that solidarity? What is it that we can do? What our government should do? And for the government to move, you need your political movement to move. And in this case, these are the same members that must then be able to say to government, this is the direction we want you to move on. This is the direction that we want to take. So that they themselves engage in the actual solidarity, not in a pronounced solidarity, but in the actual implementation of that solidarity. So I'm saying that there's a two-way traffic that we need to engage in. And I'm saying we need to find a way ourselves to deal with some of the issues. I know that we through the Speaker's office in Parliament, we took a decision that we are going to be active. We've attended a number of solidarity conferences. The Speaker has decided that through her office, we will be able to do certain work at the international level. We've attended a number of solidarity, whether they be in Rome, whether they be in Spain. We've attended those solidarity movements. A delegation led by the Speaker went to Algeria, but she had to come back, and Honorable Obed proceeded to Western Sahara to engage in the Western Sahara. That delegation was followed by myself, and that delegation was followed by the delegation that Mambutu led. We have started that active element, and we are continuing asking ourselves, what else do we need to do? I know that if it was not because we are going for elections, and the Speaker's office was working on a program to collect English books to donate to as part of the educational program that they've been working on. Of course, the political situation in the country created its own pressures, and other things had to be reassessed to say, what is it that's possible, that's not possible. But I'm saying that it's a two-way process. The difficult, and of course, people will say that being the chair of foreign affairs, I should not say that. But the difficulty is that our diplomats, because of the nature of the engagement at the level of the diplomatic community, they tend to deal with these issues within those confines. But maybe it's also the environment we created as the politicians, that they then tended not to go beyond certain parameters as defined by that diplomatic engagement. But maybe what we need to do as politicians is to a little bit push them out of that environment and push them to a situation where they'll be able to support political work that we need to do as politicians and in engaging and raising the public profile of the struggle of Polisario, and in fact explaining more of the negotiation.
And therefore it means that between our two missions, they might have to look at the situation where they keep a quarterly or a bi-monthly update of the developments in that region, so that that update could be circulated amongst members to know, so that the information must flow between our missions and the members of parliament. They could, in fact, they don't even need to send to all members of parliament. They could send it to the secretary, who will then email it to all members of parliament. Just by email, do a bi-monthly update. This is what is happening. So we can spread information amongst people, because it's through that information that allows people to develop their consciousness, to develop their understanding of the problem. And I'm saying that from that level, at their better place to deal with that, because they're dealing with these files on most daily basis, and they should be able to feed to their politicians. But I'm saying that it's a two-way process, and it's the members of this parliament that must then decide how they want to move forward and how they want to actively make their commitment to solidarity materialize. This meeting comes at the time when the ANC International Subcommittee will be meeting, I think, on the 5th to the 7th of November. And it's up to these members to then say in that subcommittee, what are they going to do and what are they going to say? And that will then inform the ANC in the next 5 years how it responds to different international relations. So this meeting comes at that particular time when we are preparing to go for that 3-day workshop as international subcommittee of the ANC. And I'm throwing it to them to say, to what extent will you use that meeting to materialize our commitment towards the independence of Western Sahara? With those notes, I want to suggest that we allow you to proceed to go through Parliament on the tour, and then allow members to prepare themselves for lunch. I'm told that the lunch is at Max Building, and it starts at 12 o'clock. However, we thought that we should say to our colleagues, we should give our colleagues this gift. And I've deliberately said that this is the new emblem of the of Parliament. Our Parliament has changed the emblem, and given the fact that our Parliament has two houses, this is the National Council of Provinces. They launched it yesterday. That summarizes the history of the National Council of Provinces, and it goes through the Sunday affairs of the Central Committee of the National Council of Provinces. And here, this is the name for the book of Parliament. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Arms from South Africa. You know, they are drugs that can walk all over their mind, not be damaged. We buy them from South Africa. But when they buy them from South Africa, they work for the American army. But when they in Iraq, they work for the American army. The South Africans are against the Americans. It's the invasion of Iraq. Quite complicated. My father has made a lot of money sending his family, and they've got a problem.
Thank God.
only for something very urgent, or to kitchen drinks,
for food.
50 degrees. So the family moved from here. 6 days at a time, 6 more. Just around some bricks and three hot, but something. So we don't have the city. After now, no city, no bridges. All the bad sand, more than. We travel in the drone and the water drain from outside, with water inside, and it can be cold.
Other homes than the family, because they were
our body, most of the problems. The only stories about their country, what is it like.
They have people who live there. For example, my grandmother is living in Kupai territory. I never seen her. Yes, they don't allow us to go to Kupai territory. The Morocco don't allow us. And as a journalist, you never could have gone there. They don't allow us to go there. From the main place, the journalist and the public forbidden to go there to have discussions about the Sahara, how they live in the prisons and how they live.
Thank you.
Thank you. Going back to the office, but I also see someone. Yeah, in St. George's Mall. Where are your offices?
Where do you work from? My office.
I'm going to walk with you to. But I'm going to go see Mark and see only in 92.
Okay, when does it speak to Gate?
No, just send my phone. No, she's just send my phone right now. I actually sent her an email which she replied to yesterday. So just say that Clive says hi. Hey, thank you, man. Thank you for keeping me in the loop. I'll send you an email thanking you for.
And then I'll reply.
Good. We'll keep it.
Seven times, and I think it's in the chair that we're coming up with the same good thing.
it's unfortunate. The timing is bad because the president is in Central Africa. He's going to West Africa. He's not around at the moment.
The president?
No, our president. So it's not like they could
send him for a
month. I think he's demonstrated that he's the president for longer. Hey, what did I hear about Mr. Knapp?
No, not him. That's not him. That's
the
billionaire.
Who's billionaire? So it's not our Knapp?
No. Old man.
No. But billionaire was the guy who used to come visit Martin Fiore a lot.
Hello.
Thank you. Ah, last time I got...